Welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, a weekly podcast from Hobeck Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, mystery, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of running a creative business in this challenging world. We'll hear from the people who make this possible, the authors, the cover designers and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on the Hobcast Book Show from Hobeck Books, as we combine trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello.
And welcome to the Hobcast Book Show for 2023. This is episode number 103, and you're very welcome to join us. Happy New Year to you. My name is Adrian Hobart.
My name is Rebecca Collins.
And together we run Hobeck Books, UK independent publishers of the following, well, several genres.
Oh, several. Crime.
Thrillers.
Suspense.
And mysteries.
Oh, you got it.
I did for once. I'm a bit more on it this today. As you can hear in my voice, I've had a bit of a virus this week, so it's been sort of a stop-start week, really. So I sound a little deeper and throaty.
Man fluitis?
Something like that. Yeah, it wasn't the greatest. But I'm recovering, and it's just as well, because we've got a massively busy week to come. More of which later. Let's first of all mention who our guest is. It is J.M. Simpson. Joe Simpson, who is an author of, well, actually two series, one that's already out and one that is coming out. We'll talk more about her later. But Joe, it was a great interview and got a great deal of it. And I thought, what an interesting, she's taken the theme of you know, setting her books at a sort of imaginary coastal resort based on Tenby, but using the National Lifeboat Association as the RNLI.
Yeah, we were trying
as the focus of her novels. It's really fascinating.
We were trying to work out, weren't we, whether anyone else has used the coastal rescue, of any sort of coastal rescue
I'm
as
not
the focus.
Well, I think possibly there must be, but none come to mind.
No. And I quite like that because it's different.
I do think it's one of the best things about Britain is the RNLI and the way it was set up to, you know, stop shipwrecks that were blighting Britain's shores in the 19th century particularly. You know, basically, you know, had a one in three chance of coming home alive, it felt like at times, because, you know, there were so many disasters.
They pull random people out the sea that have been swimming, gone a bit too far as well.
Oh,
don't
all
they?
Sorts of things. Awesome. They're amazing, amazing.
People on Milo's.
Absolutely. Right, well, we'll talk to Joe Simpson a little bit later. But first, of course, we kick off with the early 2023 news. And let's just reflect on last year's book sales to start with. This is the fiction top 50. It's in fact, this is the UK top 50 of all books, but it's dominated by fiction.
Yeah.
And to be perfectly honest, Colleen Hoover hasn't really crossed my radar that much.
Well, I see Colleen's book everywhere because, well, obviously, you know, that's why we're talking about it. And I've picked it up a few times, read the blurb, put it back, picked it up. And so I'm sort of almost ready to read it because I'm fascinated. Why is it so popular? I know it's the book that TikTok kind of elevated.
Yes.
And it's well known for that. But still, you know, so many people have read it and then it's gone like snowball effect. There must be something.
Absolutely. So what we're talking about specifically is Colleen Hoover's It Ends With Us, which has sold for Simon & Schuster 693,850 copies last year. And then at numbers 2, 3, and 4, it won't surprise you, it's our favourite man. Well, we talk about him a lot. And that, of course, is Richard Osman, who has sold over 500,000 copies for The Bullet That Missed and The Man Who Died Twice. And The Thursday Murder Club, which has been out for over 2 years now, still sold nearly 500,000 copies last year. So he's doing amazingly well. But then you look down the list and there's Colleen Hoover again with Ugly Love at 6, Verity at number 7, and It Starts With Us at number 13.
Yeah, I think there's two versions, aren't there, that they had out.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, just astonishing.
Oh, is it Ends With Us and Starts With Us?
Yeah,
it?
So no, it's different
that's
titles.
That's just me being dim.
a little. But then you look down the list and then J.K. Rowling rolls in with Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, the very first of the series, over 20 years old now, still selling 144,000 copies.
Yeah, but I think that the thing about Harry Potter, though, is that as the people who read it as children, they grow up and they're now having children and they're introducing it to their children. So it's going to go on for decades. It'll sort of have waves of popularity, I'm sure.
We've also got two books by a former guest of ours, Andrew Childs and Lee Child. And The Better Off Dead has come in at 17, and No Plan B was another one of the collaborations between the two brothers as Jack Reacher continued under a sort of new ownership, if you like. Fascinating. And then the first of the non-fiction books is at number 8, and it's Jamie Oliver with One, which is his book about, you know, using, I think it's...
Pot, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's basically tray baking.
Tray and pot.
You know, he's done very well. I mean, you know, his books do shift a lot of copies, it has to be said. How many has he sold for Michael Joseph? 354,324. Very impressive. But not many indie authors on this list. In fact, I can't see any at all. And that is, again, a reflection, I think, of the fact that these book sales are reflected on sales through shops. And it's so hard for indie authors to get in.
Supermarkets as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you're gonna get those at knockdown prices, aren't you? So that's a sort of reflection of last year.
And I haven't read any of the ones in the top, what you read as the top.
No, well, you know, you are busy. You've been busy this week reading another Hobart book. I've been reading a couple of pieces of work by our authors, and that keeps us busy.
Oh, totally. I don't know if we should hint too much, but I've read the second book of one of our authors, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I've got some feedback for the author, but nothing major at all. And I'm about to read book 1, 2, 3, 4 of another one of our authors.
Well, I'm in the middle of the work in progress of book 4 for one of our authors, and I love, you know, there's certain aspects I absolutely adore. I think it's really bravura writing as well. So more feedback to come for that author in question when I finish it.
Yeah, so if you're listening, we have been very busy reading your books.
And another author sent us a chunk of a prequel, which was brilliant, kept me gripped. I mean, literally bolted to that pink chair opposite us for the 2 hours it took me to read it. I absolutely adored it.
You might have to give me a hint who that was. I can't think.
Well, it's set in Africa, so that's
Yes, I know.
Right, further news, and we'll whip through this because we're very conscious that quite a bit of feedback we get is saying, "Could you make the we love your program, but could you keep it down to an hour or
so?" No one has said that to me.
Well, I get that feedback, so wow. We're going to endeavour to try that. Anyway, it's dominated the press worldwide this week, and that is, of course, Prince Harry's memoir, Spare, which is due to be published this week officially, but came out in Spain semi-accidentally last week, which has meant that the British tabloid press got themselves hold of a Spanish-language copy and started to reveal tons of extracts from the biggest self-harming book in the history of publishing, as far as I can see. It's done him no good whatsoever, but made him a lot of money.
Now, before we recorded this podcast, I did request 2 banned words.
Megan and Harry. Yes,
Megan
you
and
did.
Harry. But I retracted that because it's so big in the news. I mean, even this morning, I took one of our boys to rehearsal, and that's all they were talking about on Radio 4. They had a bunch of journalists and they were discussing it. So you can't escape it at the moment.
Well, look, from a publishing point of view, it's been a massive disappointment for Penguin Random House because they had so tightly controlled the access to this book. And somehow it came out in Spain. I'll read this. This is in the bookseller. So apparently it's actually called something completely different in Spanish.
Well, it would be.
yeah, but actually totally. I mean, it's not called Spare in or whatever the Spanish word was. It's called En la Sombra in Spanish, which translates as In the Shadow. And Reuters reported that several bookstores in Spain were selling the much-awaited memoir before it was withdrawn, so the papers managed to get the hand on it. A spokesperson for the Spanish publisher, Barcelona-based Playa Illanes Editores, which belongs to Penguin Random House, told Sky a very clear launch protocol was established and communicated to all customers so that the book would not be marketed before that date. Everything points to the fact that some customers have breached their commitment to the publisher and have put the book on sale before the agreed date. So it's actually coming out on Tuesday, the 10th of January, the day after this podcast is published. And it previously been reported the book was being printed at Clay's in Bungay, Suffolk, which is where we do our some of our print runs, under conditions of great secrecy, with staff being checked on their way out for copies.
Do you know they did that with the most recent Harry Potter, I remember.
Yeah, I remember that.
And also because Bloomsbury, I know that they had very strict rules on who could access the files related to Harry Potter, and they all had to sign, you know, usual non-disclosure, blah-de-blahs. But I remember the printer issue as well, that there are people who just sort of coming in and out and checking sheets, and they have to be really stringent on this.
Oh, absolutely. Well, look, I mean, let's. I mean, you know, we won't talk about what's in the book because it's just so, it just does my head in, really. But there is this other story which has been fascinating us, and we mentioned this some time ago, was this this story about a junior member of, I think it was Simon Schuster, wasn't it? He was working at. Basically, he's pled guilty. I can't remember his name now. I'm going to have to try and find the article.
Who say something?
Yeah, it was something. Yeah, that's helpful. Basically, he'd been stealing the manuscripts of some of the leading authors. He stole over 1,000 manuscripts as a junior member of the Simon & Schuster team.
It's amazing how he got away with
Ian
it for
McEwan
so long.
Was a victim. I know, it's absolutely extraordinary. Anyway, he's pled guilty. We'll skip over that because I can't find the details right now. The final thing we wanted to talk about in this section of the programme was that Apple have launched a raft of audiobooks narrated by artificial intelligence.
Your favourite subject.
Oh, boy, here we go. To its Apple Books platform, but maintains it remains committed to celebrating and showcasing the magic of human narration. Yeah, right. Well, I have listened to, in fact, what we'll do is we'll play you a sample in a moment. But I have listened to the samples they've given. And it's fair to say that it's a fair approximation of narration, pacing and timbre and all those sort of things. But what they're playing are non-character elements. So it's the narrative bits, which, you know, an AI can cope with. But can it then synthesize characters?
So cheaply.
I mean, this is the thing. You could probably synthesize some character voices because they've got a whole load of samples of different people speaking and they could plug that in. But who, I mean, that's almost as time consuming as someone narrating it themselves.
But then a book such as Catch as Catch Can, which is very much in Liverpool.
Yeah, right? And Sin, which is the most recent one I've just published. Yeah.
Or Scottish crime fiction, or, well, any region of the UK or even anywhere in the world. And especially if they've got characters from different areas and part of their culture and their accent is integral to who that character is.
Mm.
Then, you know, as an author, you'd think you'd want that character voice with the accent and the, what, you know, all that goes along with that.
Mm.
But if AI can't cope with that,
it will eventually. It will eventually. And look, you know, we've reached out to a Ukrainian firm who have been recreating the voices of Star Wars characters, for whom the actors are too old now. Their voices are too old to sound like their younger selves. So they did some work with Luke Skywalker's voice. So Mark Hamill did a track and then they youthified it. And the same with James Earl Jones, who now is too old to voice Darth Vader. But Apple's website reads this. More and more book lovers are listening to audiobooks, yet only a fraction of books are converted to audio, leaving millions of titles unheard. Many authors, especially independent authors and those associated with small publishers, aren't able to create audiobooks due to the cost and complexity of production. Apple Books Digital Narration makes the creation of audiobooks more accessible to all, helping you meet the growing demand by making more books available for listeners to enjoy. And they have divided their AI narrations to what the organization, that's Apple, of course, call them soprano voices and baritone voices. Well, I'm definitely a baritone. But I think we should judge for ourselves. So I'm just going to play. I've lifted this from the Apple website. I do hope they don't sue me for copyright, but I'm sure they would like the publicity. Judge for yourselves how these sound.
Movement in the greenhouse drew his eye, and a woman emerged. At first, he wasn't sure. The woman was about the right age, but there was something different about her, about the way she carried herself. The bright aura that had always surrounded Allison was missing from this woman. And yet, there was something achingly familiar about her.
I looked up to find a wall of trees had materialized ahead of us. I hadn't noticed, because I'd been staring at my feet. I couldn't believe the fields actually had an end. It was further away than I would have liked, but at least I now had something tangible to run toward.
So you've heard the clips. What do you think?
I don't like them. And I think it's partly because they sound a bit sci-fi-ish still to me, you know, a bit Star Trek-y. And there's not much variation, not only within the accents of each voice, but also that voice itself can do.
Yeah, I get the feeling there's that character. I'm trying to remember what the name of the character is in the Orville.
Yes, yes.
Who is sort of a cyborg of some sort and has that sort of Data style quality. I mean, it's not Stephen Hawking, you know.
No, it's not.
it's a lot better than that.
It is a lot better than that, but there's no feeling. There's no emotion.
Well, what's interesting is, so I'm just looking at the terms and conditions that apply to doing this. You can produce using this system. And obviously it's not going to be appropriate until they put some British voices on it. And they're not doing crime at the moment. They're doing romance and self-improvement titles.
So, yeah, non-fiction. And when you're listening to non-fiction, you don't care that much what the voice sounds like as long as they get it right and it, you know, it's clear. So I can see a market for non-fiction.
But I found myself listening to those and just getting bored. Actually,
well, I was switching off.
I didn't feel that human condition. So let's say you're an independent author, or we decided to do it this way, which we wouldn't, but you know, you could get your thing produced. It gets released through Apple Books and exclusively through Apple Books, and it allows you, funnily enough, to go and make another production for other platforms. So this could be used in libraries. And this can be used through Apple Books. Now, from our experience, Apple Books don't actually generate a heck of a lot in terms of audiobook revenue. It's still Audible. Spotify has started to increase the contributions they've made because they've gone on to audiobooks as well. And they're the owners now of Findaway Voices, our main distributive platform. So interesting. I'd be interested to hear your views, listeners, to what you think of that. I mean, it is a big development, and what are Apple? What they haven't made clear is how much they'd actually charge for an AI production. And the other question I would have is, at what stage does an author have any control over the QR process or, you know, the QA?
Probably nothing, I would imagine.
Yeah.
This is what you get. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So, interesting times.
Well, related to that, if I may. Today on Facebook, actually, one of our authors has had a practice with AI writing software, something called ChatGPT Doohickey. Do you know? Have you heard of that?
Oh, yeah. I'm really across. No, I've never heard of it.
I don't know if I said that right, but that's what it is. And so he thought he'd give it a go and see if he could write a story using this, very basic. And so he gave it a structure. Let's write a story about a possessed library with a three-act structure. AI replied, sure. Here is a rough outline of a story with a three-act structure that features a possessed library. And it has produced Act 1 and bullet points, Act 1, Act 2, Act 3. You can sort of input, it creates something and then you say, okay, well, how about the main character does this and how about this happens? And the AI goes, sure, here's a revised outline and, you know, does it again. And then it actually writes for you. Now, he's put all this on his Facebook post, Dan.
This is Jonathan Peace.
I hope you don't mind, Jonathan, me talking about this. But it's fascinating. And so it's actually written something. And you read it and you think, okay, plot-wise, structure-wise, it's okay. But it doesn't have a bit like the narration, it doesn't have that feeling, that human condition, that human...
That magic.
The magic. It doesn't have the magic.
Yeah.
And would people want to read a book written by AI?
From a technical exercise, possibly. But, you know, realistically, and this is where I have a real problem, because, I mean, certainly in the UK, we're undervaluing the creative input of authors, and indeed all of us in the industry, the publishers. And we've been talking about this, and we talk about this with Joe Simpson, actually. And, you know, the fact is that the cost of books is artificially low. It's less than a Starbucks coffee for an ebook in most cases. And it just, you know, that has to change. Much as this country tends to undervalue a lot of its most important people, its public servants, I would argue, and that's a little bit of politics that's creeping in there. It's the same for the creative side of things. So, interesting. We are going to be talking to a representative of Plotter, who are an alternative to the Scrivener software, which a lot of authors use. And Plotter is one of these semi-AI devices, which will allow you to be much stronger in the sort of, it works on a genre basis so that it can help you prompt you to write certain types of books and put the right sort of beats into your script.
Yeah, and I do think that's a good thing, because that's a tool. So it's not doing the job for you, but it's assisting you in doing the job.
Before we have that interview at the end of the month, we'll be fiddling around with it. I shall play with it and just see whether it helps me structure my thoughts.
Well, I did say
anything that would do that would be great.
I did say to the guy who approached us about coming on the podcast, I said, we're going to have a play with it. And we are both complete pantsers. So it'll be interesting to see how it copes with somebody who is a complete pantser.
Absolutely. Let's get to our feature interview then this week, which is Joe Simpson, writing as J.M. Simpson. And she's created a three-book series so far, the Castleby series, which is loosely based on Tenby in West Wales, as she describes. She's also written a Scottish series, which she's currently looking for representation and publishing. So interesting to think. But I think what's so interesting from this interview, here's an author who has... created, each time she creates a series, she creates a world in which characters populate, and almost the place is more important than I'm not saying that more important than the characters, but is a character in itself.
Yeah.
And we had a great fun talking to her, and as ever with these interviews, I mean, we just love talking to anybody from the creative field, and Joe really gave us a sort of good spirit for the start of 2023.
Well, our first guest of 2023.
It feels like we've had about a year off, but we haven't. It's 2 weeks, I think.
I wish it were a year off.
But yes,
anyway, no, I don't mean that.
The first guest of 2023.
And of course it is Joe Simpson, writing as J.M. Simpson. Welcome to the Hopcast Book Show.
Thank you very much for having me.
How do you get started writing in a new year? Because I think Christmas for everybody in the creative world seems to crash in and break up the flow. So in terms of, you know, starting again for a new year, when's that going to happen? How do you get it going again?
Or have you already?
Do you know, it's been quite an interesting period for me, because I finished a standalone novel literally just before Christmas. And then you do the whole put it aside for 24 hours, have a load of nightmares about it, wake up, fill the holes that you've been dreaming about, and then you kind of put it aside for a while. So I felt I'd sort of reached a bit of a natural break. And when we were away, we went to Tenby for a few days for New Year, sort of 4 or 5 days in Pembrokeshire. That sort of heavily inspires my current series of books. It's based on Tenby. It's called Castleby, but it is actually Tenby, with a little bit of Lyme Regis, a little bit of Sidmouth, a little bit of lots of other different places in Cornwall thrown in. And I find I don't write there, but I just sort of absorb inspiration. So my husband kept saying to me, is everything all right? You're really quiet. And, you know, and I've just got a head full of plots and things like that. And, you know, so I think for me, I just sort of I spend sort of this couple of weeks off, which is pretty hectic with dogs and teenagers. You know, I don't have to tell you that. You know, so you don't really get a spare minute. And then once sort of things start getting back to normal, I think to myself, right, you know, I've really got to do something. So I kind of take a few hours to write down all the ideas, fill up the little notebook, one of which there are many. So I empty the head that way and try and resist the temptation to start a million new projects or new books or whatever. Had one at 3 o'clock in the morning this morning, which is, you know, and I'm just desperate to write that down now.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm on a deadline now. I've got edits to do for the next in the Castleby series, which will be out sort of late spring. So much as I want to sit here writing, I'm editing, which is, yeah, not one of my favourite things to do. But, you know, you have to do it. And it's always quite nice to revisit a book and then think, actually, what the hell was I on when I wrote that?
In terms of that editing process then, who do you work with on that?
So Heather J. Fitt is my editor.
She's actually coming on the podcast.
Yeah, we know Heather, yeah.
I love Heather. So she's been with me from the start. So it was, you know, it was one of those sort of weird things. I'd worked with another sort of editing firm, and I found it really difficult because there was a sort of a go between me and the editor that I was working with. So everything was really diluted, and it was really, and in the end, I just thought I can't work like this. You know, I need to be able to have dialogue and kick things around. So I put a search out for lots of different editors, and I found Heather, and we had a really nice chat over Zoom, and she read some samples of my work, and she's been part of the dream team ever since. So she's the editor, and Abby Rutherford is my proofreader. She's awesome. She's just like got a forensic eye.
Yeah, so I know Abby as well because, we follow each other on Twitter, and she sent me a message. I can't actually remember how it started off, but she sent me a message, something about, I think she'd listened to one of our podcasts about how we were talking about how difficult it is when you're freelance and you're trying to juggle and you're trying to make money. And she said, I felt everything you said. And so we sort of started talking about working in publishing and, you know, all the difficulties of it. So it's such a small world. We know everybody.
Yeah, it is. And I think, you know, and I wanted to sort of, I made the decision to self-publish the Castleby series. I did a few offers, but they just weren't right. I didn't get a good feeling in my gut about it. And weirdly, this is, I was talking to someone about this the other day, to another writer. For me, the deal breaker is the covers of some of the publishers. If I immediately think, I don't think we're going to gel on the covers, because I think covers are one of the most important things.
Sure.
Then you've just, you know, you just got no hope. So I did, you know, I decided to sort of self-publish the Castleby series. And it was just really important to me to get consistency with the team and you know, and have our little dream team. And it seems to work really well because, you know, obviously Abby and Heather know each other really well. And I've got, you know, a lovely guy who does my book covers, who, how he interprets my excessive ramblings and random pictures that I send him. I don't know, but it's always like Christmas when he sends me a new cover. So
I know what you mean. So our cover designer, Jane Mapp, she always titles her emails incoming. And when I see incoming, I think, oh, it's a cover. I get really excited.
And then there's this process where we get the covers and Rebecca will say, she'll look really tense when I...
Yeah, because I never know what he's going to think. Because sometimes...
Right, because I'll look at them independently and I'll go, yeah, one overall, like the text on three, too dark on number two.
Yeah,
you know, I'm quite brusque, aren't I?
It also depends on what mood he's in. If he's in a bad mood, he's like...
Most of the time.
He just goes,
Jane's listening to this, you know.
So do you ply him with good stuff so that you'll get a favourable outcome and get him to choose the cover you want?
I should make a coffee for before, shouldn't I?
It's then, whiskey in it or something.
A little massage, you know.
Are we on to you now?
Yeah, candles, petals in the bath. Yeah, that sort of thing. That's the sort of thing.
You have showers, petals in the shower. Does that work? No.
Favorite meal. Yeah, favorite music.
Pink Floyd.
At the moment, it's Pink Floyd. I don't know why. I mean, I used to be a total anti-Pink Floyd.
We did a lot of travelling over Christmas and New Year, and every time we're in the car together, Pink Floyd. I didn't complain, but I just, a couple of times I thought, oh God, Pink Floyd again.
Well, the thing about Pink Floyd is when you're driving, it creates that sense of unhurried, you know, it's emotional and there's lots and lots of depth to it, but it's not forcing you onto your foot down on the pedal and dicing. I mean, I'm quite happy to trundle behind a HGV at 56 miles an hour or whatever it is.
I really like Pink Floyd.
Yeah,
because you can be quite a, should we say, emotional driver.
Yeah, I've been trying to. Yeah, why are we talking about this? We've got to talk to Jo about her books in the Custody series.
We've gone round on a tangent.
We have. We've mentioned the books.
Let's go back.
Let's talk about your principal series. And what I love about the concept is that you've got a character involved in the lifeboats. And that's kind of the thrust of each story is around that. How many shouts have you been out on? Have you done some of that for research?
I haven't been out on any shouts. I think there'll be a whole insurance issue there.
Yeah, I'm sure there is. Yeah.
So it was quite an interesting process because I think it's safe to say that I think I've been in practically every R&LI shop there is in the country.
Lots of jigsaws.
When my daughters were young, it was an absolute obsession of theirs. So wherever, and because we always have to holiday by the coast because of me, it was sort of, you know, they went hand in hand. So, you know, I've been in numerous lifeboats. I've sat there, I've looked at the gear, I've talked to the crew, never saying to them, I'm writing this series or anything like that. So the research for it was actually quite difficult. Because despite sort of numerous requests, there wasn't really any engagement from them to sort of help me on this journey, which was quite hard. But there's a lot out in the public domain. And I've, at the beginning of the book, I've had to say, you know, I've taken quite a lot of literary license here. Because also, I think the more technical you are, you just lose the reader. You know, if you're just bogged down in all of the significant detail, if you like, I just think that's just too much. So I have employed a lot of literary license with regard to that. But then, you know, saying that, you know, I've got the mechanics handbook for the Tamar self-writing lifeboat. So, you know, so it swings and roundabouts. But I do research for a living. So I think it's quite safe to say research is quite easy for me. But I have to temper this. I have to temper the story with the fact that it's fiction. And I don't want to get bogged down in lots of procedures and this, that, and the other. I want to try and keep it real, but keep it as a story as well.
That's interesting because, there's obviously a big industry. Graham Bartlett.
I was going to say
that. From the police procedural point of view, it's the UK's go-to man. If you want to check out whether it works, from that twin perspective of being realistic enough to not let cops choke in their coffee, but at the same time give you the liberal creative license to create a story that works. I don't suppose there is an equivalent in the RLLI and the whole lifeboat world.
But so I think the first novel that was very much around the crew. In fact, weirdly, it was the first title. The working title was called The Crew, but there was thought to be too many sort of gang connotations with that. So we dumped that.
And you went with Sea State.
I went with Sea State, yeah, because, you know, it's a sort of a nautical term, if you like. And I quite like the vibe that it gave off, really. It just sort of came to me at about 2 o'clock in the morning. I thought, oh, that's quite a good idea.
Sounds like that's when you get your best ideas.
Sometimes. So the first book is very much, you know, we come to the crew and they've had their own traumas, they've lost crew members, that, you know, the skipper nearly died. So that's sort of the first of the story is very much around that and various shouts. A lot of them are actual shouts that happened in real life that I've got from various RNLI publications and their newsletters and stuff like that. But the second story and the third, there's that element there within the town, but we've got different characters coming in. And I think the third one, I think there's just a few mentions of the lifeboat crew, maybe like a shout, I think there's one shout. Because I didn't want to sort of do it to death, really. And I wanted, you know, different elements. In book two, we've got a soldier, you know, an ex-soldier coming in and trying to get over his trauma. And then in the second and the third book, we've got a little bit more of a sort of a crime overlay going through it as well, which I don't know how that happened. That just happened. It just completely happened one day. I find the writing side of things to be a complete mystery to me. I sort of sit down and I think, oh, I think this might happen today. And then before I know it, I'm 5,000 words in and I'm in a direction I have never anticipated that would happen.
That's a wonderful feeling.
Yeah.
That is the best feeling. That I'm the same.
And yeah. I really like it when writers say that, because I think there's a lot of merit in the method of plotting your book out beforehand and having everything, you know what you're going to write and kind of filling in the gaps.
Well, I respect but I can't do it.
Exactly. However, I love the fact that you're basically saying, you know, the sort of creative process is stronger than your mind, taking you off it in the direction you didn't expect.
And it's really interesting because in the book I'm editing at the moment, the fourth one, in my mind, very clearly I had a character who I thought, right, so this is going to be the villain, if you like, one of the villains. And when I started writing this character, I just couldn't do it. I physically couldn't write this character. And this character is now, couldn't be more different to a villain. So I've had to now introduce another character who is a villain and keep this other one in there. So it's crazy. And I would love to understand how it happens, but I have no idea how it happens.
They didn't want to be a villain. It's well, yeah. They just didn't want to be. Yeah. And they were saying to you, no, I'm not going to do it.
Yeah. I mean, I take my hat off to these people that laboriously, you know, sort of plan it all out. And, you know, and there's like a million post-its for every artist. Yeah. Yeah, I can't do that. I'm random bits of paper and scribbled words. And then, you know, and no one is more surprised than me when I type the end and I think, oh, goodness, I don't know how that happened at all. So, but it's a lovely process. I think it's such a lovely process to be able to create these worlds, if you like. Yeah. And inhabit these worlds. And it sounds really odd, but I actually really miss some of them. You know, I've pretty much spoiled some places for myself because I've used them as a basis and then created this whole, and I think, well, I want to live there. But then I think it's actually not like that in real life. So actually I don't. Yeah. I want to live there in my book.
Yeah, you want to live in the book, not in the.
Yeah. So I've set this new series, and I'm trying to find a home for it. And it's a series set in Scotland, and this time, rather than the lifeboat, we've got a little bit of a theme of mountain rescue, because in these remote, you know, Scottish, everybody's in mountain rescue.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So there's a shout, and there's like 50 people go out.
Yeah.
So, you know, everybody and his wife goes out and is part of mountain rescue. And I was very, very lucky in that I did quite a lot of research with a wonderful man who is the head of mountain rescue up there. So he was lovely in telling me what worked and what didn't work and what I could do, take artistic license with and stuff like that. But I think, you know, and what I've done is I've used, you know, different parts of various areas of Scotland and brought them together to make this one place where there's another. It's sort of, you know, very sort of community based, and I really want to live there now. And I miss it, and I think, oh, you know, I really want to get, because I've written two there, and I know what I'm going to write for the third one, and I'm sort of a bit desperate to get started on that. But then, you know, when I was in Tenby, I had a really good idea for book six in Tenby, so I really want to get started on
You've
that.
You've got too many things to do.
No, I've got a day job as well. So, you know, it's...
Oh, gosh.
Well, what's coming through is you have total passion for what you create and the places that you create, which is fantastic. I'm really drawn... I mean, I get this sense, because where are you speaking to us from? In Kent, is it?
Yes, yeah.
Right, so I feel this pull to the west in your location choice.
Well, you are on the other side.
I grew up in the West Country. So my parents, I think when I was about 4 or 5, my parents moved from Essex down to Devon. So I grew up in Devon and Cornwall, and I love Devon and Cornwall. I don't love it in the summer at all.
Nobody does. So.
You know, and I remember, you know, I learned to surf in sort of Newquay and Woolacombe. And,
yeah.
You know, and that was in the days when, you know, it wasn't, you know, it was sort of quite cool. You know,
yeah, it's de rigueur now. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, now it's just, my goodness me. And I'm noticing this, when we first discovered Tenby, which was probably about 15 years ago, because the kids were tiny, it was like Cornwall used to be to us, yeah. You know, and that's what we loved about it. And it was so, you know, it was really reasonable as well to stay there in the summer. And now it's just, you know, it's just like Cornwall.
I think it is that thing of when you're growing up in Devon and Cornwall, because we were students in Devon in Exeter. And I worked there, and Cornwall's been my, you know, place where my soul lives, I think, most of the year. It is the most extraordinary thing. And I think what's so great about those two counties, and I don't discount the others, but boy, does it, it's about storytelling.
Oh, yeah.
The community, the way people talk to each other. My grandmother she was in Somerset. And everybody stopped to share a tale. It wasn't just sort of, how are you, Margaret, la, la, la. It was everyone shared whatever happened, and it was a bit of gossip. It's a fantastic storytelling place, isn't it?
Oh, it is, yeah. And my parents had a shop in a place called Axminster, which pre-recession was a really bustly market town.
Yeah, I know it.
Yeah, and so we used to have a shop there, and I used to work in it, slave labour, from a very early age, till I was tall enough to actually key into the till and for it to open and not knock me out. And the characters, and I'm sure this is where half of my characters come from, you know, the characters that used to come in and sort of chat and share a yarn, you know, are sort of almost part of your DNA now.
Yes. Yeah.
Because, you know, there's so many different types of people, and it was, you know, depending on what the season was, and, you know, and I think, you know, when you spend a lot of time in sort of customer facing stuff, I did quite a few stints working at sort of hotel and restaurant in Porlock Weir in Somerset as well. And that, again, you know, these tiny little communities that, you know, and you all just are this tiny sort of community, and you're sort of thrown in together for the madness that is the sort of the summer holiday period. You know, and it was just the most amazing sort of time, and almost a lovely sort of framework to build characters off and stories. And
absolutely. I think that is very well summed up, actually. I mean, my memories are of Crewkerne, which is not very far from Axminster. And my dad, my grandfather, my step grandfather, I should say, was a farmer in Ilminster.
Area. Oh, yes.
So, you know, I know that area, but he was the great storyteller in my life, I think. He would sit me down as a very young boy with all these incredible stories of his life on the farm and the generations going through and all the sort of scrapes they used to get into, and how he was just old enough to sign up he was into the Royal Flying Corps in 1919, but the war ended, so he didn't have to fight. And then the second time round, he didn't have to fight because he was a farmer. But all of the things that he told me about, all that era of the communities and the people and the characters and the people who worked on his farm, is amazing.
Mm.
Amazing. And it stuck with me, that sort of sense of you know, the oral tradition, I suppose.
Yes.
But I remember as a student, do you remember this when you were traveling around? I mean, I don't know if you did this much, but in Exeter, when I used to catch the bus around Exeter.
Yeah.
And it was all these elderly Devonians, and they get on, and there'd be a chap would get in, and he'd be surrounded by ladies, and they'd be having a good old natter at him, you know.
Oh, no,
oh, so nice to see you, Derek. Oh, yeah. You're looking well, you know. Sort of, yeah. Do you remember? Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Or they pick on younger people, saying, "It about time you had a bath."
Yeah, yeah.
Something with that hair. Have I haircut? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. They were never shy in coming forward, were they? No. And it's just a wonderful thing. Now, what I'm really so fascinated about is the way that you've, with the first series, and I'm getting the impression that possibly with the second as well, is that the star of the show really is the place that you've created, and that you've got these sort of adjoining stories, but the focus switches from one protagonist to the next. Is that right?
It kind of is, yeah. And I didn't really, it didn't really sort of occur to me until the first book had come out, and then the second one. And people kept talking about the strength of characters and how they loved characters, and they felt like it, that they wanted to live there. And this is something that I get consistently. You know, if you could live anywhere, people say, "Oh, I'd live in Castleton." You know, you know, and I think I'll take that because you know that's lovely. But I do think, and it's not a conscious thing, but I like to create a sort of a community, and I see it. You know, I see it very clearly. You know, I see where all the, you know, where everybody lives and everything like that. And then I see all these sort of key people that are intrinsic to the local community. And in coastal villages, you know, particularly, I mean, this was particularly the case, you know, 15, 20 years ago, the lifeboat crew, everyone knew the lifeboat crew. You know, they had a special area in the pub that they used to go in. You know, nobody, you know, no locals went and stood there because that was for the lifeboat crew, you know. And so it's very much like that. And I think, so when I write now, I try to sort of think, who are the kingpins, you know, of the town, if you like? Who are the people? And I think that's growing up in a sort of a smallish market town. You know, you have these sort of linchpins of the community and these sort of communities within communities. And I think, yeah, I think that's, and I sort of create these places. So the Scottish one, yeah, it's the same place. It's the same. This is sort of a bit more crime fiction, I guess. The same sort of put upon type detective who's trying to solve these terrible things. And, you know, and but everybody, because it's a small community, has some sort of involvement in it.
Yeah, some agency in it, yeah.
Yeah, my husband's like, awful lot of people die in this community, Joe. I'm like, yeah. But it's fiction.
That's always the case, though, isn't it? I mean, someone else, one of our other people we interviewed said the same thing, that actually if you added up all the deaths in the tiny community, yeah, then no one would ever live there. Statistically, you've got a good chance of being done with.
You can't write a book about nothing happening or everybody's...
No, you have to be in a big city, but...
I recognise what you're saying about the lifeboat, because we spent some time in Mousel, and of course that's the home of the Penley lifeboat crew that were lost, sort of over Christmas, wasn't it? And 20, 30 years ago or something, I think it is now. And there is this feeling in the pub, in the ship, that there is this corner where they go, the current crew, and you're not supposed to go anywhere near it. I don't know if you felt that.
Yeah, but also, particularly with that place, I did feel a sort of almost a... not haunted exactly, the memories, the weight of the memories.
Cornwall has a lot of that, doesn't it? I mean, you know, certain places have a feeling that even from the gravestones and whatever, there's a certain heaviness. But Mousel, despite being one of the most beautiful spots, it's lovely. It's very, very, you know, there is that feeling of that loss, because they lost the entire crew, didn't they? And the people they were trying to save in one night is extraordinary. Heroism that they, you know, they went out at all into the strength of wind that they were facing, and they were, you know, smashed against the rocks, and it's truly tragic place. But I can see why it's such an opportunity in a literary sense to go for it. And I don't know of any other authors doing it.
Yeah, you're the only person who's you know, used the sort of the lifeboat as part of the focus.
To my knowledge, yeah, but it's weird because I mean, I don't think people perceive it as it. I don't think they kind of know what to expect if they know that it's sort of the backdrop is a lifeboat crew. I don't, you know, I think that might actually put some people off. But I think the concept for me is, and this is what draws me to this. So it's the concept of these men and women who leave everything they love to plow into a stormy sea and rescue a stranger. And you don't know what you're facing. You know, you might have left your Christmas lunch or whatever, or your anniversary, or you know, any of these things, your kid's birthday party. And you, without question, go and put your life at risk for other people. And it's, you know, that it's that that intrigues me. And it's that that initially gave me the idea when I watched the lifeboat launch on a really stormy night, and I thought, my goodness, you know, who are these people? What are their lives like? So that's sort of where the sort of the idea was born. And it's the same for this, you know, the Scottish series. You know, again, it's this sort of this concept, you know, will you go out in a massive blizzard with 50 other people to look for some idiot that's gone climbing in a pair of flip-flops? And you sort of think, you know, there's something really special about these people that risk everything to save others. And I think that's quite a nice sort of platform to write about, you know.
And so, they generally have other day jobs, don't they?
Well, yeah, they all, yeah. Some of them are doctors. Some of, yeah, they've all, yeah.
Yeah, they all have, you know, they're not doing this for the cash.
I can remember, so in Borth on family holidays, so I remember that you would go into a shop and you wouldn't know who were the lifeboat people necessarily unless they told you. But then they would set off the cannon thing. Yeah. Which used to frighten them, yeah. Absolutely frighten me to death. I'd be sat on the beach, bags in the air. But they'd just come out of wherever they were working, and just go for it,
and
do it really quickly as well. And it'd be like, you know, if someone sprinkled salt on an anthill or whatever it is that you do.
Yeah, it is. It's absolutely incredible. But I mean, they do employ some full time members of staff in particularly busy areas. You know, so there's always like the skipper there, I think, in busy areas. But for the most part, it's all just volunteers. You know, they don't get paid for it. You know,
that is incredible, isn't it? They're risking their lives.
Yeah, I just find the whole concept unbelievable. You know, and it was so worthy of a story, and I couldn't really understand that nobody had sort of thought about this before. And weirdly, I wrote it as a TV drama first of all, because I saw it really clearly as a TV drama.
Absolutely,
I can see it. I think it would be a really good one, because look, you think about the especially crime, it's so saturated with police procedural stories.
It's a natural fit,
and I think, understand that people love that, but sometimes something that's got a little bit of an edge or a little bit different, and we're an island nation, you know, this is quite a significant part.
I have a feeling someone's going to pick it up, but I mean, what's Nick Berry doing now? Is he available to play Doug?
He's probably quite old now.
He played the Harbour Master there was a show at West Bay near, just along from Lyme Regis, and Nick Berry played the Harbour Master.
If you would sum up your experience so far of being a writer, an author, being self-published and all the other things, I mean, how would you sum up that experience? Challenging.
I think challenging times a million. I mean, I always thought that I had quite high levels of resilience and self-motivation, but there's absolutely nothing compared to what's needed in this game. And I think, you know, self-publishing, my learning curve has literally been almost vertical since I started. And you know, obviously hindsight is the wonderful thing, and I wish I'd done stuff differently, you know. And I think the industry is so different now, and it's so geared up for celebrity writers and you know, and I just think, you know, with the best will in the world, unless you've got something really, really different and really, really special, you know, it's a really hard slog. So I think I love the writing element. I find everything else very difficult. The PR side, you know, because I have no budget for anything. So, you know, the PR side is a slog, because there is, I think with the best will in the world, there's still quite a lot of, I don't know what the word is, it's not stigma, there's different attitudes towards self-published authors.
Yes.
And it's almost like you're not really worthy, I think. And for us, you know, we kind of, you know, there's nobody sort of banging our drum for us, you know, so you sort of have to try and bang your head or just hope that if someone reads your book, they'll tweet about it or say something nice about it, you know, and that's like gold dust. But it is incredibly challenging. And I would say if anybody's embarking on this journey, then, you know, bucket loads of resilience is needed more than you would ever think. But I mean, I guess it must be the same for you guys. You know, I've listened to your podcasts and, you know, and it is, it's a really sort of sobering business, I think, you know.
I think you've probably gathered from our most recent podcasts, we just feel it's unfairly skewed.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think that the publishing revolution, as it was, you know, the self-publishing revolution and the tools and the platforms which to do it are less effective than they when they first started, because I think the pandemic changed. I still believe this. I think the pandemic changed everything.
Once
the traditional publishers lost their cozy bookshop deals because they were shut, they had to do something to shift books, and they discovered what we'd already knew, which was online ebooks. They were no longer sniffy about it and spending money in Amazon ads and Facebook ads, and they've done it, which they weren't doing. And basically that playground has been taken over and the bullies are back. And it just feels that way. And you know, where is the place that, you know, the independent sector can flourish, that the traditional publishers aren't using at the moment? I don't know where it is. I don't think anyone does at the moment. And I think that's the big problem.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it doesn't help either in the self-publishing world, where you have people marking their own homework, if you like, and then just, you know, uploading it, type the end, and then upload it to Twitter, to Amazon. And, you know, and that fills me with horror as well, because I think, you know, it sort of, for the writers that kind of do it properly, go on the journey properly and, you know, spend time editing, you know, at our own cost, and, you know, spend time proofreading, making sure we got a proper cover, not that it's knocked up on the back of a fag packet. And I think, you know, sometimes we're sort of lumped in with these sort of people that just sort of randomly type stuff and then upload it for all to see. And I wonder whether or not there's going to sort of be any change to that sort of process soon, or whether it will just still remain the same. We're all sort of lumped
it's
in
difficult,
together
isn't it? The same because umbrella. If as anyone can upload a book, which is a true fact, it means that there are people who will just think, excellent, I'll just write something.
Well, there is that. I think you have to, I mean, there's a rough with the smooth here, isn't there? Because clearly everyone in this conversation is doing it the right way in terms of trying to produce the best professional product they can, that is indistinguishable from something that the big five have put out. Let's put it that way. But the whole thing is, there's always going to be a slipstream where other people can just take advantage of that platform as well. And actually, who is the person who's going to become a gatekeeper? Is it Amazon? Yeah. I don't trust them for that, because let's face it, on an almost weekly basis, it feels like there's always a glitch in their system, which, you know, makes it impossible to publish a book, or, you know, they threaten to take you down or whatever it might be. Imagine that happening to those of us who've worked really hard, and then Amazon decide that the quality threshold is X and you've fallen short of it. Where do we go then? Yeah. So I think unfortunately we have to lump it with
we have to put a lot of trust in readers themselves.
Yeah.
And that you were talking about word of mouth, and I think word of mouth is very powerful. And I as a reader, if I read something I love, I will tell everybody and their dog that it's a brilliant book. And so we have to hope that a reader picks up somebody's manuscript they've uploaded to Amazon, haven't edited it, it's full of typos. They will either not tell anyone about it, or they will put a review on it. I think most readers are quite kind. They want to support self-published authors as much as any other writer, you know, any of the traditionally published authors. And
well, I suppose the other question is, how do we support each other? because at the moment, you know, this is an opportunity for us to share some ideas and introduce you to our listeners, which is great. But that's one way. But we've got to do more, I think, as a group of people. And I know that Ally, the Alliance of Independent Authors, does a lot of good work. But it's at a certain level, I think. I don't think it's really bringing together the community terribly well. I think it does a lot of stuff which is important and represents the interests with all the swirling pressures around the publishing market. They try and sort of campaign on our behalf. But it's not necessarily making us feel that we're part of something. So there's got to be some way we can do that. But, you know, again, who's got the time? Who's got the money to do it?
Mm. Yeah. Money, I think, is the key, unfortunately.
Yeah. I think also, you know, some of the sort of the literary festivals and stuff like that, you know, have, you know, they have the big names there. And, you know, and I get that. But, you know, where are the, you know, where are the smaller publishers? Where are the authors showcased? Yeah. There, where are the self-published authors that, you know, have had some success with their, and they just don't seem to think that they're almost, that their voice is worthy, I think, in some cases.
Yeah, that's something that I've advocated for a long time, that, you know, the Harrogate fringe needs to be a thing. It really does.
Yes, it so does. Yeah, I totally agree.
And you know, recently they've had their second marquee, so why isn't that being placed into the hands of people who can, because it's sat there doing nothing most of the time, that brown marquee, apart from the odd, I dare say, publisher event on a Thursday or something. It should be an opportunity for, the small guys to, you know, and they may only draw an audience of 20 to 30 people away from the main tent, but doesn't that lift the whole event and make it just that much more inclusive? I've never had the courage to go and talk to the organisers, but I mean, I think
that's not true. We did suggest to Denise Mina when we interviewed her, didn't
true,
we?
True, but she was director of the programme last year. But I mean, you know, she'd done her bit. She was drinking the champagne and giving thanks that everyone turned up. Anyway, let's get into, before we disappear down the depression hole of independent publishing.
Just on one more point, though. Okay. There has been some change. So if you think about the Crime Writers Association,
yes, true.
You can now submit yourself as a self-published author for awards, which was I think is a massive change. People moaned about the money, but you know, it's a charity. They have to get their funding from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And there are small literary festivals, which we've taken part in quite a few of them now. So Slaughter in Southwold, Halifax.
There's lots of noir events around the country where we're getting
it's
in. Yeah.
It's only a little, small change, but
incremental.
If we push more,
yeah.
We'll get there, I think. Yeah. I wouldn't be more optimistic.
Okay, all right. Well, let's go for the point where everyone's really been just sort of sitting there going, yes, very nice, very nice, very nice. Right, get to the random question.
Okay.
So let's get to the random question. Okay, here we go. Rebecca's random question.
What is the strangest thing you've ever eaten?
It was some weird-looking shellfish on the island of Mykonos
that was
in amongst some utterly delicious tiny little pink squid or octopus. I think they were pickled or something. There was something random in there which actually just looked like a huge bunch of snot and was treated in much the same way.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's interesting if you order that. I mean, I'm thinking of France, where I ordered fruit de mer one time for a birthday, and you know, you get these, you know, the cake stand full of all sorts of random stuff, and there's always some ectoplasm in there somewhere. It's like something out of Ghostbusters, isn't it? And you just think, what is that?
That's
I know it's not an oyster, so what is it? You know, that's, I mean, you take your life in your hands with this sort of thing, don't you, with shellfish. You won't touch shellfish.
No, anything with eyes, lives in shells, has tentacles, I'm not interested.
I'm trying to think now, what's the weirdest thing I've eaten? I mean,
well, I can tell you my weirdest thing.
Go on.
Paint.
So I was at primary, it was my first week of infant school. First week of infant school, you know when you blow pictures? Well, I sucked instead of blew. I didn't tell anyone that I'd consumed some paint. I went to bed that night and thought, I'm gonna die in the night. I'm not gonna wake up. I panicked.
It was poster paint, was it?
I was too scared. Yeah, I was too scared to tell my mum because I thought she'd be cross with me for eating poster paint. And I woke up the next day, I was fine.
Oh.
But that's the strangest thing I've ever eaten.
I've eaten a witchetty grub in the outback in Australia, which was kind of nutty, but it was alive, so that was a bit odd.
Oh, I couldn't eat anything alive.
I've eaten crocodile. In fact, most of their endangered native species seemed to be on the menu when I was there in 1990. And I just remember going around the Kakadu National Park in Northern Territory, which is the one that they filmed Crocodile Dundee in.
Yeah.
And you go in these one of these metal flat bottom boats, similar to what you see in the sort of Southern America, USA. And you're going to look at the wildlife and the crocs and whatever. And every time the warden or the ranger who was driving the boat pointed out something to us, the bloke in front of me was a restaurateur from Sydney, and he said, how would you cook that? So it'd be like a little bit of butter, a little bit of garlic maybe,
and you put anything in butter and garlic,
about a little bit of paprika, that'd be really nice on a this rare sea snake or water snake or whatever we're looking at, which there are only six mating pairs in the park or something. And he'd be going, yeah, I bet that'd be really good on the barbie. You'd have to cook it like flesh fried initially, and then you're going, blimey, O'Reilly. I mean, everything he thought was on the menu, including these 5 meter long crocodiles, which would snap him in half.
Need
in
a big barbecue for that.
But
I bet it all tastes like chicken.
Yeah, tastes like chicken, right? Yeah, crocodile did taste a bit like chicken.
Yeah, it tastes like chicken.
When it boils down to it, yeah.
Wouldn't you barbecue it?
Don't even go there. Well, look, Joe, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us on the Hobcast. We've gained a lot, and I think we both want to go on holiday in both of your locations, so get on and build it.
Well, thank you for having me. I hope I haven't rambled on too much about the joy of writing.
Not
we like people who ramble about the joy of writing.
That's why we're here. We ramble like we are professional ramblers, apart from the actual outdoor bit.
Okay.
Well, I'm quite partial, but
Yeah, you'll struggle to get me out in this sort of this time of year. Anyway, thank you so much, and all the best with those future projects.
Thank you very much. Really good to talk to you,
J.M. Simpson. And
we didn't even mention ketchup.
No, we didn't. We didn't. Amazingly. Well, look, we've got so many interviews lined up this year. It's been amazing. You put out a tweet before Christmas, and it's just gone crazy.
Well, I mean, stupidly, I put out the tweet just as we were setting off for a 3-day. Tour of the UK over New Year's Eve, which was a big mistake. So I put out a tweet saying, anyone interested in coming on our podcast in 2023, let me know. We are now booked up to the end of July. Believe it or not, we have got enough guests to see us through to the end of July. And that doesn't even include people I've vaguely said, oh, we'll get in touch with you in the new year. So
It's fantastic.
Amazing. So I was trying to arrange all this on my phone while we were traveling, and it was quite tricky, but I managed it, I think.
That's great. Well, our next guest next week is
Anne Coates.
Anne Coates, who is published by Red Dog Press.
She is indeed, yes.
A sort of veteran of the crime scene.
And we've been hoping to talk to her for a while, haven't we, actually?
It was
great that she approached us.
Yeah, we're looking forward to speaking to Anne. So that's next week. Well, the week ahead is, it's fair to say we're fully back to work now here at Hoback. And we've got lots and lots of author meetings, all sorts of things going on.
I know. It's something about New Year, isn't it, where people say, oh, we should catch up.
And yes. So well, understandably, because we really, we're very determined to, as you'll have gathered from our podcasts over the last few months, it's very hard to guarantee anything in this business. But you can at least put together a structure and a set of aims that you're trying to achieve. And that's an important time. So, I mean, New Year is always a time for that in personal lives and in business. And that's what we're going to be doing.
Yes. And I'm going to learn the guitar this year.
You are. And you're making great strides. I bought your guitar for Christmas.
Making great noises, you mean?
No, well, you're just doing, you're doing really well. I'm very proud of you. It's great. So join us again for the Hobcast Book Show next week with Anne Coates. And of course, every week we'll endeavour to keep the programme going. Every week we love doing this, and we love your company here on the Hobcast Book Show. But from myself, Adrian Hobart.
And myself, Rebecca Collins.
Thank you so much for joining us, and we wish you a wonderful and
creative
week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Hobcast from Hobeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hobeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to The Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.